Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. This building, as you're probably very well aware, is absolutely cram-packed with holders of high and important offices. But there's one high and important office that we don't hear much about, at least outside the building, and that is the high and important office of President of the Press Gallery, the guardian of the freedom of the press in this building. We're very lucky today to have the very distinguished occupant of that office, Karen Middleton, who's too well known to need any introduction, being a very distinguished journalist with the SBS, the ABC, the Canberra Times, having had a very distinguished career in journalism already. So we're very privileged to have her here to talk about relations between political process and the press. Please welcome Karen Middleton.
Say I've learnt my first lesson about checking that the printer has spat out all the pages before you come downstairs. So sorry about that. Thank you for coming. I'm stunned that there are so many people here, and I'm very grateful. When I wrote the blurb for this lecture, I did it in a hurry, and the kind people from the Senate said, "Oh, it's a bit racier than usual." And I've now learnt another lesson, which is write the speech before you write the blurb, because now I've got to try and live up to it. Forgive me if I don't. Anyway. I have never been to South America, and I haven't seen a piranha, as it were, in the flesh. A friend of mine here in Canberra does, however, have a stuffed piranha on top of her toilet. It's about the size of your clenched fist, a taxidermy masterpiece with the most horrendously enormous teeth. And it sort of smiles at you like it might launch itself at your jugular as soon as you've turned your back and dropped your knickers. The experience must be even more disconcerting for those whose ablutions require them to look it in the eye. It is one scary fish. Portraying journalists as piranhas is, I admit, a bit of a cliche. But the fishbowl analogy seemed too hard to go past when the good people of the Senate asked me to offer some thoughts on the strange parliamentary coexistence of the pollies with the press. I will, of course, be conceding that one of these two species is voracious, flesh-eating and insatiable. And yes, that is us. And the other, traditionally, to pursue the analogy, is its prey. But I'll also point out that in this particular fish tank, the hunted have developed ways to dramatically minimise the risk of being eaten. It's a bigger tank than it used to be, and they have more room to hide, although that's not all that's behind it. By hand feeding, overfeeding, and selective starvation rations, they've managed to tame our aggressive instincts, limit our breeding grounds, and significantly reduce our habitat. Without some effort to fight back, I fear our traditional role may become endangered, if not extinct. As I said, the piranha tag isn't new. It's a favourite descriptor of those who don't like us all that much. Having led with my chin on the title of this lecture, I went searching for some background on piranhas, using the trusty tool so beloved of a journalist who's got a long speech to write and a looming deadline, Google. I found a blogger who goes by the name of Joey Skaggs and who's published some very amusing guidelines for baiting, catching and cooking journalists. He compares us to sharks, barracuda and, yes, piranhas. Quote, "They are extremely territorial and defensive," he advises, "and will repeatedly attack either singly or in large groups. You can usually find them behind hidden agendas." He outlines a series of recommended hooks and lures: sex, controversy, incompetence, power, revenge, little guy against the system, anything with an animal or a child. He also lists useful tools for reeling in a journalist: conviction and purpose, irony, humour, wit, confidentiality, deception. "Be patient," he urges the would-be angler. "Once the hook is set, they usually jump in the boat. And believe it or not, many others simply follow suit. Often feeding frenzies occur, and you might even catch more than you can handle." He suggests that once caught, though, journalists puff up and should be iced quickly. It seems real piranhas are actually, apparently, a popular food fish. Who knew? Even more fascinating, a piranha caught on a hook and line may be attacked by the others, turning on your own kind. Imagine that. And while it's commonly known that piranhas are found in the Amazonian, Guianas and Paraguayan river systems, I was delighted, a bit appalled and really not all that surprised to discover they've also been found swimming in the Potomac River in Washington. Apparently they don't do so well there in the winter. Anyway, who would have thought there'd be such a cheap and easy link from piranhas to politics, just waiting for a shameless journalist to exploit it? In this national capital and this particular fish tank, some argue the parliamentarians and the media should be separated, at least by glass, to avoid one being eaten alive by the other. I guess that's understandable. We in the media can be voracious, as I said, and vicious. When we smell blood, we circle, we strike. Sometimes the more merciless among us enjoy taking a single debilitating bite and leave the victim swimming in circles, missing a fin. Other times, in a feeding frenzy, there can be little more than a carcass left. We're not all piranhas, of course. Some of us are parrotfish, blowfish, goldfish, silverfish. But as far as reputation goes, we all tend to be caught in the same net. After all, it only takes the suggestion of sharp fins or gigantic teeth to make people want to get out of the water. In politics, the feeding goes in both directions. Journalists pursue politicians, and politicians pursue coverage. And when they don't like the coverage, they pursue journalists. At last week's church service to mark the opening of Parliament for the new year, Anglican Bishop Tom Frame was clear about who he believed was the predator and who was the prey. His remarks were to the politicians and about those of us who deal most publicly with them. Quoting now, "Very few care or have any regard for your feelings or those of your families who are often deeply wounded by the arrows that are hurled at you," the bishop told the politicians. So please don't say, "Oh, it comes with the job," as though by saying that it absolves the people, it absolves the press from such appalling behaviour. "We can do better. We ought to do better. You deserve better," he told them. But there was a second message too. "There are some things that we cannot demand from others," the bishop said. "Respect readily comes to mind. It's not gained through persuasion, intimidation, or coercion. Respect can only be earned." He was right on both fronts. Some of us in the media can be terribly cruel, occasionally oblivious to the hurt we cause in pursuit of a good story or just a good line. That is as true in politics as it is anywhere, and probably more so. But at least as often in this part of the pond, we can find ourselves in receipt of some heavy-handed persuasion, intimidation, and if not quite coercion, then trickery at least. Bishop Frame didn't seek to excuse either set of behaviour, and I certainly don't suggest that being on the receiving end of one justifies resorting to the other. But between the press and politicians, and on politicians I'll speak mostly here of governments because governments have the most political power, it would be wrong to suggest only one is doing the devouring. Despite how we're sometimes portrayed, journalists don't spend their days looking for new ways to destroy the careers of the nation's elected representatives. We are frequently, perhaps even mostly, legitimately pursuing stories that are in the public interest, though sometimes there are differences of opinion on how public interest should be defined. Those stories can occasionally cause considerable discomfort to those who feature in them. We can find, through the pursuit of an issue of public interest, that we thwart political ambition, stymie a promotion, or obstruct someone on a path of least resistance. And then we meet considerable resistance in return. As tools to be used against pesky journalists, persuasion, intimidation, and trickery have been around for years. Many of my colleagues recount colourful tales of abusive phone calls, withdrawn access, threats of future non-cooperation, and punishment for perceived bad behaviour. They mostly laugh about it later, mostly. When former Labor Minister Roz Kelly's resignation was rumoured, her colleague Graham Richardson tried to shut down the speculation, launching one of those routine all-out assaults on those who reported it, ridiculing them for writing rubbish worthy of nothing but fish wrapping. Of course, shortly thereafter, Kelly did resign, and then suddenly so did Richardson. As a parting gift, a couple of journalists gave Richardson a dead fish wrapped in copies of their newspaper. He bellowed with laughter and called it the perfect mafia present. Politicians also regularly use the media to get at each other. One senator, now retired, used to enjoy leaking provocative anonymous quotes to newspapers, deliberately using another colleague's recognisable turn of phrase. And two members of the current opposition front bench, watching another colleague doing a terribly serious late-line interview on the ABC, spotted the telltale outline of his ever-present mobile phone in his top pocket. They fell about laughing in an office downstairs, watching him fumbling on screen as they rang it. Twice. I may or may not have been present to witness that. But the relationships are not always quite so jolly. In 1990-91, the leadership rivalry between Bob Hawke and Paul Keating split the press gallery as each enlisted commentators and columnists to his cause. On the night Hawke finally lost to his rival, he threw open the doors of the cabinet room and put on a huge party. But any journalist he saw as having sided with Keating was barred. There were stand-up rows at the door and almost fisticuffs as Hawke's defenders squared off against those they blamed for his defeat. Some of us weren't tarred with either Hawke or Keating's brush, probably because we were too young and irrelevant, and we wandered right through the cabinet suite, drinks in hand, looking in every cupboard drawer and swinging on every chair. ASIO must have been in there for weeks afterwards. There are occasionally moments, though, of strange solidarity, like September 11, 2001, when John Howard and the travelling media were all caught up in the terrorist attacks in Washington. On the lawns of the ambassador's residence the following day, as he prepared to fly out of the country in specially opened airspace on the vice president's plane, Howard asked that the cameras be turned off, and then he apologised for leaving us behind. We told him we had work to do. So, there is a sort of mutual understanding that develops if you hang around here too long. Elsewhere, I think they call it Stockholm syndrome. But most often in the relationship, it's us using them and them using us, with the blowtorches applied in both directions. When Paul Keating was Prime Minister, he famously went after the West Australian newspaper because of a highly critical story it published about him. The revenge and ostracisation went on for years. There are rare occasions, of course, when the politician is on solid ground. Some 20 years or so ago, when I was working at the Canberra Times, a national debate was raging about tax and specifically the then Treasurer Keating's personal arrangements. Some newspaper executive, in his wisdom, had decided it would be fun to publish photographs of Keating's residences in both Sydney and Canberra, complete with their full street addresses. I got to the office very early that morning, and the only other person on the editorial floor was my colleague Graham Downey, affectionately known as the God Reporter. It was so early that neither of us had actually read the paper yet, though Graham had a better excuse than me because Graham is blind. He also has a very black sense of humour and had back then a very small windowless office close to the executives. So when the editor's phone rang, he got there first. He was slightly puzzled when a torrent of abuse spewed into his ear and he was very polite, asked who was calling. It was Paul expletive-deleted Keating, who explained in straightforward terms that he was really quite upset about the houses and the addresses and who did we think we were, etc., etc. All, as you can imagine, punctuated in a most animated four-letter fashion. Still trying to decipher all this, Graham said, "I'm sorry, but I don't know what you're talking about." Keating went into an apoplectic rage that someone who worked for a newspaper had not even seen its front page. "What are you?" "Yes, blind?" I still remember the smile that came across Graham's face. "Actually," he said, and he really enjoyed the pause, "I am." The treasurer only paused for a moment and then the abuse resumed. Perhaps it's an even greater sense of past media persecution that's inspired the leader of the current government to bite back on a much greater scale and harness the volatile power of the circling media. Over the past 11 years, the Prime Minister has learned to control media coverage like none before him have. He knows how to minimise the risk of the uncontrollable feeding frenzy. He knows when we're hungry. In these days of the 24-hour news cycle, that's all the time. And either feeds us, starves us into submission, or just slowly raises the water temperature till we start to roll over. I would suggest that history will record the control of the bowl, if I may continue to torture the analogy, as absolutely central to John Howard's success. This government's media management strategy has flourished through a combination of restriction and distraction. Restriction is hardly new. The previous government certainly engaged in it too, though not as effectively as its successor. Under Labor, the application of the Freedom of Information Act became increasingly subjective, with journalists' requests routinely finding their way onto ministers' desks for political scrutiny before approval or denial. The monitoring and, by extension, control of information was alive and well then too, in the guise of a unit we used to call Animals. Animals was officially called the National Media Liaison Service, which laboured under an awkward acronym until it was rescued by a few cheeky vowels. It was squeezed into an L-shaped set of offices just downstairs and along from here, around the corner from the Prime Minister's suite. Its rather unsubtle location on one of the building's main thoroughfares was offset by frosted windows and a lack of obvious signage, giving it the slightly mysterious air of a spy agency hard at work. Animals liaising involved monitoring media all over Australia and disseminating useful snippets to embarrass or nobble the opposition. If an opposition figure made a hash of something somewhere, they had it covered. If a partial transcript from Radio Gunnedah appeared on your desk, you knew it was Animals and your taxes at work. The Coalition, much monitored and by 1996 very cranky, abolished Animals upon winning office. In its place has grown a much more sophisticated network without the snazzy acronym. It's a sort of media monitoring come spin setup. The monitoring is once again paid from the public purse, and you can bet the bill is off the charts compared to the old days. But it's now accepted as a necessary expense in these days of 24-hour news. In terms of outward information flow, it's the Prime Minister's press office that's ultimately in charge. Announcements are centrally coordinated to ensure no conflicting messages or wasted media opportunities. Ministers are assigned to appear on Sunday morning talk shows to reinforce a theme and ordered to cancel if plans change. On the wider media stage, it's the Ministerial Committee on Government Communications, comprised, not surprisingly, of government MPs, which has the oversight role, vetting and approving all government advertising and national media campaigns. Access to people and events is increasingly restricted, often attributed to security, but sometimes looking suspiciously like convenience or just playing favourites. Despite the lip service paid to press freedom, information control here is pretty tight. Some journalists and organisations are deemed useful and given extra assistance, while others are designated as either being of no benefit because of low circulation or ratings, or just being trouble. That's a practice that's gone on for decades, but it has been greatly refined under the current regime. There's restriction on our questioning these days too. When heads of government visit from abroad, the Prime Minister insists on taking only two questions from each nation's media, a trick he picked up in Washington. We're increasingly in the age of which causes heated discussion along the press gallery corridor. Where the Prime Minister is concerned, these emerge in response to a particular event: the death of Slim Dusty, a sporting hero's retirement, a triumph on Oscar night. Sometimes the comment is on request from television bureaus, sometimes it's on offer. The Prime Minister's office will agree to do a pooled interview, usually with a single television journalist, sometimes also one from radio, but restricted to the specified subject. Occasionally, there's only a camera present, and sometimes the press secretary even conducts the interview. The broadcast material is then distributed to all television and radio networks, and the transcript to all print media and wire services. It means we get a grab, as we call it, on one particular issue, which we otherwise wouldn't have. But it also means the Prime Minister avoids talking about anything else. His office argues he doesn't have the time to do an all-in news conference every day, and he does do them regularly, a conference that canvasses all the day's issues with all the media together. And they say, at least this way, we get something. It's not an entirely unreasonable point, but neither is the suggestion that this way he gets to cherry-pick the issues he wants to confront and sidestep others on difficult days. So, should we run these comments or not? It is a dilemma, and we usually do. The policies of restriction also affect who we're allowed to speak to, or rather, who's allowed to speak to us. Since it won office, the government has shut off or curtailed many traditional information sources for journalists. The large-scale background briefings on weekly coalition party meetings have been restructured, and the affable, sometimes overly helpful backbench briefers have now been replaced by savvier senior MPs whose own brief is to only offer a selective picture of what went on. The opposition has adopted the same approach. The spin can make you very dizzy. And the government's been particularly tough with public servants. Few are even allowed to speak to journalists anymore, and those the government suspects of doing so without authorisation are pursued, even prosecuted. So too are the journalists to whom they speak. Witness the case of my two colleagues, Michael Harvey and Jared McManus, from News Limited's Herald Sun. They wrote a story on the government's relationship with war veterans and how, despite its publicly sympathetic attitude, it was rejecting their request for financial assistance and then trying to spin what was on offer as generous. McManus and Harvey have now been charged with contempt of court for refusing to reveal their sources, and they've pleaded guilty. It's not clear if they'll be jailed, although the judge did indicate some hostility when he remarked recently that the journalists seem to wear their refusal to obey the demand to disclose as a badge of honour. I'm not sure how much protection a badge of honour would offer inside, but I do strongly support the non-disclosure. Some may think it's fair enough to jail journalists for refusing to spill. But what gets me in the gills is that senior members of government routinely offer journalists strategic leaks, sometimes as a kite-flying exercise to test the response to a proposed piece of policy, sometimes for other reasons. They do so in the full knowledge that the journalists, in upholding the vital confidentiality clause in our Code of Ethics, will not expose them as the source. So it's a bit breathtaking when someone else tells us something, something the government doesn't want published, and we are hauled before a court for refusing to divulge them as the source in order for them to be prosecuted. I concede that this by agreement arrangement in source protection can itself be a source of frustration for and criticism by those consuming the news, because vital pieces of context will be missing, like who provided the information and why. But without the protection of sources under the Code of Ethics, you'd know a lot less about the workings of government even than you do now. So it's a trade-off. These days, it's a lot harder to find sources without a party political agenda who are willing to talk. Whereas we used to seek information from specialist bureaucrats on the execution of a particular facet of policy, we are now routinely directed to the minister's office. That's because there is nothing now that isn't political. Everything done by government is done with politics in mind. So restriction also comes in the shape of spin. Just like the role of political journalism is increasingly to interpret events, it's important to see how the government, and slowly the opposition, is setting the context for their announcements for maximum PR impact. Take the government's new $10 billion water plan. A bit of grilling through the Senate Estimates Committee process this week has now established that it didn't go to Cabinet for approval before Mr. Howard unveiled it with fanfare in his pre-Australia Day speech. What that tells you is that somebody decided that the timing of the announcement and its potential political impact was more important than bedding down the details through the usual processes. And it's not just when, but how things are announced that's significant. In her recent dissection of the press gallery, Queensland academic Helen Esther writes about Mr. Howard having chosen to announce his decision to go to war in Iraq at a news conference rather than on the floor of Parliament, as would once have been the case. She quotes my colleague Rob Chalmers, who produces the Inside Canberra newsletter and is now the longest-serving press gallery member with some 50 years plus service under his belt. I don't know how he does it. Rob sums up the government's PR priorities when he describes Parliament House as increasingly like Mr. Howard's taxpayer-funded television studio. Actually, radio studio might have been more accurate. More than any other political leader, John Howard has harnessed the power of talkback radio as a means of communicating over the heads of the local piranhas and straight into a much bigger and, as he sees it, less filtered pond. He has a weekly commitment to each of the main big city morning radio shows, and allows a TV camera to witness his responses, and then issues a transcript ensuring that other media also regurgitate what he has to say. It has worked extremely well for him and is now so entrenched it's a practice that may well continue beyond this government. But along with all this restriction comes the artful practice of distraction. We fall for that one every time. While limiting the flow of some information, the government is a veritable font on other things, ensuring we have something to write and broadcast all the time, recognising the eternal appetite of the very hungry fish. It's forever announcing things or re-announcing things or repackaging things. Keeping us occupied is a key objective. The busier we are tearing something apart, the less likely we are to start doing laps looking for something else to munch. So, why do we put up with this? Well, trouble is, a lot of what the government is announcing is actually news. It's become very good at manufacturing news, at stashing things away in the bottom drawer to be unveiled with a grand ta-da on a day when a good, solid distraction is required. The choice for us is either go with the big, obvious story, the $10 billion water plan or the discussion paper on values in education, or ignore it and every other media outlet and go trawling for something they don't want us to know about. It's very hard to choose to ignore actual events, even if they are confected a little, in favour of chasing shadows, though the most important stories are often hiding in the weed. I think we should all probably spend a little more time in the weed and less time gulping up on the surface. But that takes a lot of effort. It takes time management, which is also always a personal challenge for me. It takes determination not to be distracted by the electronic snowstorm of emailed press releases and the insistent parade of ministers and shadow ministers wanting to spruik their wares. And it takes resources, the backing of publishers and broadcasters willing to invest the time and space in having us look for the real news instead of being dependent creatures who need feeding daily and are told what we should eat. Pet piranhas who've actually forgotten how to bite. In conclusion, I think there is more good about us all living here together than bad. But vigilance is required on our part, the part of those of us in the media, to ensure we're still doing what we're here for and not just acting as the bullhorns of government and opposition. My research into real piranhas tells me they can in fact survive as pets. But they do actually need a varied diet. And though they seem to have an endless appetite, overfeeding, like underfeeding, will kill them. And after this, I may go hungry for some time. Thank you very much.
That was very good.
We have some time for some questions. It may be difficult for the questioners to get to the microphones with this crowd, but either get to the microphones or shout is the request I make.
That's how we operate.
Anybody got any questions? Can you shout?
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. Very nice. At my last count of the contact list for the press gallery, there were 260 people working up there. I haven't dissected that to work out how many are actually reporters or writers. There are also editors, camera crews, photographers, administrative staff, because we have full television studio facilities and newspaper bureaus upstairs, and wire services. So 260 was at last count. And incidentally, the Prime Minister's press office compiles the list for us. Isn't that nice of them? Actually, I'm grateful for that because I couldn't do it in a million years.
How many in the Prime Minister's press office?
In the press office, he has three media advisers, and then he has, I think, four or maybe five assistant media advisers who do transcription and some of the administrative work and some of the junior media work.
Question over here.
How different do you think the situation will be if the press gallery wasn't co-located in Parliament House?
Yeah, it's always an interesting question. It would be a lot, it would slow everything down, which is why I think it probably will never happen, because the news cycle is so fast these days with communications the way they are that physically being located elsewhere wouldn't just mean that we couldn't harass politicians as easily, it also means they couldn't harass us as easily and they couldn't whistle up a press conference at 5 minutes' notice. And the way we work now is there's a bell in the press gallery, and if someone is calling a press conference either here or even interstate at very short notice, because they know we're all co-located together here, they'll ring the bell, and then it's sort of like Pavlov's dog. Everyone kind of salivates and comes running and finds out what's going on. So these things can happen at very, very short notice, and on weeks like budget week, you know, the bell is just going all the time, and on budget night, we actually set up cameras up in the press gallery at the press boxes, and we just wheel people through because it's just so much easier. So it would be physically much more difficult to process the volume of information that we do if we weren't here, and I think for the other side as well.
That bell is a bit disturbing.
To not have us here, yeah. Well, it might be. Look, I don't know. Some people might think it would be a good thing. I mean, there are arguments in both directions. It might be a good thing to slow things down, and we might be a little more discerning about what we cover in that case. So, you know, you could argue it both ways, I guess.
Other questions? Yep.
Actually, we don't often get enormous amounts of time to talk because we're sort of racing around following our bloke, and they're racing around following their bloke or woman, and so we don't get a lot of time. Sometimes there's a few minutes standing waiting for a press conference. It was interesting on the trip we did with the Prime Minister to the United States, Canada and Ireland last year, a number of us found it interesting, particularly when we were in Ottawa, the way their press gallery was set up. We here have an administrative committee, of which I'm the chair, so I'm the president, and we're all elected, and it's a voluntary arrangement, and it's very haphazard, and it really deals with mostly with real estate issues up there, you know, sort of body corporate liaison with the parliament, because we pay rent for our space here. So, but it's very ad hoc, and that does have its disadvantages, because it means it's hard to act collectively if and when we need to. And we don't act collectively on matters of kind of policing each other's work or anything like that, but it's sometimes useful to act collectively in dealing with the Parliament on administrative matters, on matters of access, who, when we can and can't have cameras in the building, that sort of thing. And the Canadian Press Gallery has a full-time paid director who coordinates that, and I've often thought that would be a great thing and may even pursue it. But how we would pay for that, who knows? You know, and that's the problem, because then you need to get it funded, and we don't have any money, and we never have any money. So it's a bit different in that respect. You know, they are set up in different ways, and you do observe different levels of control. I made a reference to Washington. You know, they're very tightly controlled, and there's been a lot of public debate about some of the implications of that in relation to the Iraq War. And I think there's a different culture in the States that perhaps doesn't exist here too, where they are perhaps a little more accepting, or historically and culturally a little more accepting of authority, because the presidency has this particular status there. In fact, I remember once years ago there was a press conference here, I think George Bush Sr. and I think Keating was Prime Minister then, and they were holding a joint press conference, and We were seated with the Australian media on one half of the room and the American media on the other, and when they walked into the room, all the Americans stood up. We didn't. So I think, you know, there are some cultural differences that will permeate the media anyway, and we perhaps have a well-known and documented suspicion of authority in this country that goes back a long way, and it's played out in media as well.
Now, there was a lady seated up there, yeah.
Well, I guess I sort of alluded to that a little bit, in that you know, it's probably declined. There aren't as many outlets for investigative journalism as there used to be. And you know, I work for a news service. My job is to do daily news, and it's difficult when your job is to cover the daily news to get out from under the daily news, whether it's legitimate news or confected news, and spend time doing something else. And there's enormous time pressure on everyone. I mean, we have massive volume of information to get through. So getting away from that and getting the approval and support of employers to spend time doing that is really hard. And there aren't many outlets for it. I mean, the radio current affairs, there's really ABC Radio is the primary outlet for radio current affairs pieces that do a bit more investigation. And we have Four Corners on the ABC. The Sunday program does longer pieces on Channel 9, and my own network's Dateline program has individual journalists who are freelance, actually, and they're video journalists who do shoot their own material. So they're very autonomous and they go off and do travel alone and do it all themselves. So it's a resources issue. There aren't the outlets. Maybe there's the assumption that there isn't the interest. I don't know. But I do sometimes worry that if there was a Watergate issue around here, we might not necessarily see it. And that also does, you know, Watergate, as you'll remember, depended on gutsy bureaucrats and party officials who, I mean, without Deep Throat, that would never have happened, because somebody was willing to defy the orders and speak. And that's where trust relationships between journalists and sources are really important, and that's why I say we justify the anonymity thing. Sometimes the anonymity thing is the only way you will ever get very, very important information into the public sphere. So it does not only take gutsy journalists, sorry, the word guts and gutless has been around a lot this week, but also gutsy public servants, party officials, people in other organisations that know something, have to be prepared to say so. Yeah.
Yeah, lady at the microphone.
Do you have any advice for young people aspiring to join your profession?
Don't. No. I think it's a lot harder to get into it these days than it used to be, and that's mostly just because it's sort of people see it as somehow attractive and glamorous. Let me tell you, it's not as glamorous as you might think. but I always say to people that you have to find a way to distinguish yourself from all the other people who want to become journalists, which means you have to be active. You have to consume the media, follow the news, write letters to the editor. I mean, what will help set you apart from other would-be journalists if you're going to a newspaper for an interview is if you've got a portfolio of published work. And that's not just feature articles and things like that. It's anywhere you can get anything published. You have to think very laterally about it. Write letters to the newspaper. When they publish them, clip them and keep them. Do all of that. You know, even ring up Talkback Radio, record yourself, anything that will... that will show that you are engaged, interested, capable, and set you apart from somebody else. And a good general knowledge. It's much harder for young people straight out of school to get journalistic jobs these days, because almost just as part of sort of a filtration process, they require some kind of further education, or increasingly they're taking journalists who've had a different career. You know, there are journalists who've been doctors and scientists and lawyers and have moved over to journalism because they bring some specific expertise. So you can do that later on as well, but it's hard to get into very early on, and the setting yourself apart is really important.
Now, there was a lady way up the back there first.
I guess I'll know if I get a walloping after what I've just said.
I won't be able to say it's questionable where we are getting the freedom of speech in this country.
Well, I think I sort of mentioned that I think there's a lot of lip service paid to freedom of speech, but sometimes the actions speak louder than the words, and I do feel that, and it's not just this government, it's a trend. Once people get into office, it's, you know, they want to protect what they have, and nobody likes you saying something that embarrasses them or that they don't want other people to know about. So there was a sort of natural reaction to that. But I think it has been on the increase in recent years that they try, there's an effort to try and stop the diversity of news and information, and sometimes that's a media ownership issue too. You know, we've seen media ownership laws change, their reduction in the number of owners. I don't think there's as many conspiracies about owners dictating what goes in a newspaper or on air as people suggest, but my personal view is that it's, you know, it can't be good for the diversity of news and information if you have fewer owners and fewer journalists covering an issue, and, you know, with work being syndicated everywhere. So, it's an issue, I think.
Now, there was a gentleman towards the back there, yes.
You spoke earlier about journalists working collectively on real estate issues. To what extent do journalists work collectively or collegiately in deciding what is going to be the issue of the day, how to reflect a particular event? Do journalists work individually or collectively on this?
I love this issue. Actually, there's a lot less caucusing than people think. If you open a newspaper or a series of newspapers, and in this town you can get something like 7, you know, on your front lawn in the morning. If you look at them, yes, you'll see a similarity in the subjects covered, and sometimes you'll see the same quotes used from one person to another. That is not so much because we stand around deciding what's the news of the day. It's because we are sort of, I suppose, attuned to particular issues, following them closely. So we all recognise a development in an issue when we see it. And, you know, you can argue about the way we're trained to do that and whether or not it's healthy. But I think it isn't as confected and organised as you might think. We really don't have time to stand around swapping stories with each other and working out what everyone thinks is the lead, because we're just too busy. And we'll talk to each other on the way back from a press conference or something, and, you know, swap commentary for as long as it takes to get from the Prime Minister's courtyard to the office. But there's not as much standing around and organising as people think. It is more independent than that. And, of course, you've got to remember, not only... we do put the wagons in a circle a bit when people attack the press gallery, but we're all highly competitive individual journalists whose organisations are fighting for readers, fighting each other for readers and viewers. So it's a strange atmosphere up there where, you know, we have a bit of solidarity because we all work here, and a lot of people like to criticise us for working here. But there's also huge competition, and you want to beat someone else to whatever story there is. So, you know, people sometimes forget that, I think, that the competitive side of the journalism here too, to get ahead, and sometimes as governments and oppositions play that, they know that, and they'll dangle things to somebody in order to get a frenzy going in some direction. But we are reasonably competitive.
Now, there was a question just down here.
If you couldn't hear that, it was about online content and the increasing use of the internet and whether it's affecting the way we work. Yes, it is. Because of the immediacy of online journalism, there's pressure to get things out fast. And some of the practitioners, certainly early practitioners of blogging and online journalism, tend to put speed ahead of accuracy and fact sometimes. And that puts pressure on everybody, because what we're supposed to do in journalism is check and make sure that something is accurate. Hope I haven't made any mistakes in that. But the time pressure can sometimes be the thing that thwarts you doing that properly. And sometimes I've found that online publications have been less good at that. Certainly there was a criticism of Crikey when it first was set up, that they used to just publish all sorts of things, gossip, rumour, and they fell victim to people's manipulation too. People were sending them emails purporting to be from someone in high office, which were mocked up. So there are all kinds of traps when you're dealing in online and when you're wanting to get things out quickly. And I think we all have to be careful of that. And the general pressure of the 24-hour news cycle just means that there is more of an urgency about everything. And it's not just the online factor. It's, you know, 24-hour television and you know, embedding reporters with soldiers overseas. The pressure to get everything out the minute that it happens means you're reporting one side of a conflict and not the other. And it can be an issue, a problem, yeah.
Any other questions? Yes, a lady up in the centre there.
Why is that?
The message they want to get across
I have lots of brawls with my non-journalist friends about these things, and in fact some of with my journalist friends who don't work in Canberra, about how well we do that. We have competing interests. You know, if I'm interviewing someone, a politician, and they have a message they want to get out, they will be very focused because they will have done media training, and some other person in my position will have taught them how to do this. They will repeat their message. They will, whatever question you ask them, they will say, yeah, so that's a very interesting question. It brings me to this point, which is blah, you know. And that's how they should do it as a good politician. If you've got a message and you want to get it out, it's frustrating for us. So we have to find creative ways to pursue those issues and hope that we can extract the information that we want. But the difficulty we have is we have, in broadcast journalism, we have time pressure. If there's a live interview, it may only go for a minute and a half. You may have a politician in for a minute and a half, or on the 7:30 report it might be longer, it might be 5 minutes or longer, 10 minutes sometimes. But you're conscious that you don't want to lose your audience by just haranguing and haranguing and haranguing, and you have to make a judgment about when to harangue and pursue and point out that a question hasn't been answered and when to move on. And that's a very difficult thing to do. You know, someone with a job like Kerry O'Brien's, I mean, it's very, very difficult to manage that, to adequately inform and entertain as well, because you need to hold people's attention and audience and cover important issues and make a judgment on the run about how far to pursue something and when to let it go and move on to something else. And there will, whichever path you choose, there will always be somebody who will say you did the wrong thing. So we have to make a judgment about it. It's incredibly frustrating. We would love everyone to just go blah all the time. Be interesting world if they did. And it's up to us to learn how to ask questions properly and pursue that and to be listening to the answers. It's also very hard, you know, in a live interview, you're thinking, where am I going next? Because the last thing you want to happen is for your mind to go blank. So you can sort of just tune out what they're saying to be looking for where I'm going next, and then you might miss something. So it's a balancing act, and the more experienced among us do it very well.
Now, there was a question up here for you.
Embarrassment sells better than compliance. And has the rise in the sort of opposition that we have currently provided more embarrassment for the government through the media?
You mean since Kevin Rudd took over? Well, is it us doing it, or is it Kevin Rudd doing it, or is it Labor under Kevin Rudd doing it, or is it the government being nervous because Kevin Rudd's there, or because we're focusing on Kevin Rudd? I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's a perfect storm in a sense. There's a whole lot of things that contribute. Politics, you know, this is why some of us hang around in it so long. It's quite fascinating because it's never as straightforward as you might think. It's psychology as well. So, yes, there is more focus on the opposition, and then critical focus maybe on the government because there's an opposition that appears to be resonating more with the public. And it's a sort of a chicken and egg thing. Where does it start? Is it starting with you and the opinion polls, or is it starting with us paying more attention to them? I don't know. But, you know, most commentators that I've heard in the past week are saying they feel like the government is under more pressure than it used to be because the opposition seems to have renewed confidence, renewed focus for whatever reason, whether that is all Rudd or whether everyone suddenly feels like they maybe could actually win the election. And because there's a lot of attention, new leaders always get a lot of attention in the short term anyway in the media. And we talk about honeymoons, and then there's a question about when the honeymoon ends and when it's just actually like this. But I think a lot of things contribute. And sure, our attention, I'm not saying, you know, we're not part of it, our attention will help to, you know, can help to boost one side and lower another, not deliberately, but just by the fact that we focus on them. I don't know if that answered the question.
Perhaps a second last question. I think we better make it the last question for a lady up here.
Do you believe there's a difference between the major parties and how they use the media, and has it changed much in the last 11 years since Howard became leader?
Yeah, well, I guess that's the point I was making. It's changed a lot, partly because the media and the news cycle has changed. We've got, as I said, we've got CNN now, we've got broadcasting all the time, and newspapers aren't just once a day anymore. They're updating, if you I don't know if you noticed this, but all the daily newspapers now updating their news stories online, and their journalists are under some pressure to file for the net before they file for the paper. So that the whole culture of news and information transmission has changed with the internet and the immediacy and text messages and all that. So the culture has changed as a result, and then you get people who are better than others at learning how to work that, and that's the point I'm making about John Howard. He is exceptionally good at it. He is very, very good at it, and he has the resources of government to assist him. You know, you can be good at it, but if you haven't got the tools to work with, it's harder. And so oppositions don't have the tools. They don't have the funding. They don't have the bureaucratic structure to help them. There's been criticism of whether the government has appropriately or inappropriately used taxpayers' money to fund advertising campaigns. And it's a fine line. It's a debate that will go on, because some of those advertising campaigns are legitimate exposure of government policy and things that people need to know about. Some of them look awfully like political advertising. They've got the infrastructure and the support. So that helps when you've got a clever person who knows how to deal with it and the support, you can get streets ahead. Now, I think Kevin Rudd's pretty clever at it too, actually, and that's starting to emerge now that he's leader. He's learning about those things very quickly. And so we're starting to see a different sort of a contest, because he's playing kind of guerrilla warfare in the media too, which is interesting but exhausting. They both don't sleep, I don't think. It's ridiculous.
Okay, I'm anxious to let Karen get back to her deadlines and keep within our time, so join me in thanking her for a very good lecture.